somebody like Peralta, though, he's on a very affordable contract. Brewers might be looking to get out of that money, on their end. It might be a little bit much for them. So he's somebody I would keep an eye on. I would say like him and Imai are probably the most likely.
Hello, everyone. I'm Ryan from Fireside Yankees, and I'm joined by an amazing, incredible guest in the New York Daily News beat writer for the Yankees, Gary Phillips. Gary, we're excited to have you on. I know it's a cold, wintry day, or it's been a cold, wintry weekend, but how you holding up, my man?
I'm doing all right, doing all right. Like you said, it's cold outside. The hot stove, at least in Yankees land, is pretty cold as well, so kind of searching for things to write, going off of leftover material from the winter meetings this past week, waiting for some new stuff to happen. So far, it's all quiet.
Yeah, I mean, it's been cold outside, as you mentioned, cold in the stove, and at least for Major League Baseball, there's been some big moves. Alonso going from the Mets to the Orioles, the Diaz signing, which seemed to kind of come out of nowhere with the Dodgers, but in Yankee land, not a lot of mystery or surprise that's happened over the last few weeks. But you have had a lot of articles come out on some very interesting topics in Yankee land. And the first one I wanted to touch on was Ryan McMahon. Now, you talked about in your article some of the offensive changes the Yankees believe McMahon can make, that there is something to tap into there. Can you talk a little bit about that article and what the Yankees think of Ryan McMahon?
Yeah, so the Yankees basically at the winter meetings, Brian Cashman and Aaron Boone were both talking about how they can, quote, unlock more in his bat. I want to preface this by saying when the Yankees first acquired McMahon, they said things along similar lines, and as Yankee fans know, McMahon was not a very productive hitter for them. Great in the field, great defensively, that's where the majority of his value came from. My guess is that is where the majority of his value will continue to come from moving forward, in his Yankees tenure. But the Yankees keep saying that they think there is more in that bat. Now, a couple reasons they might believe this is if you look at some of his underlying metrics, there is, encouraging signs with his average exit velocity, his hard hit percentage, he walks a good amount, he chases at a very respectable rate, or doesn't chase at a respectable rate. McMahon's problem is that his whiff rate is crazy high, his K rate is crazy high, he doesn't square the ball up very much, and he also struggles with in-zone contact percentage. He was actually the second worst in baseball in that category last season. But as I wrote at the Daily News, if you look at Jazz Chisholm Jr., he's got a very similar offensive profile from the left side. Obviously, Jazz has a lot more speed. He can make a lot more things happen for himself. He can make things happen more once he does get on base. But some of those advanced metrics that I was just talking about, that I just mentioned, are very, very similar as far as the percentile rankings to McMahon. Biggest difference is that Jazz pulls the ball in the air at a much higher rate, which, it's a good thing to do in general. It's a really good thing to do if you're a left-handed hitter at Yankee Stadium. So McMahon actually pulled the ball in the air a 17% clip last year, which was a career high, but still probably not as high as he wants to be doing given the rest of his offensive profile, given the ballpark that he plays in. So maybe those are some things that the Yankees can look at and work on with him. They talk a little bit about how he was communicating with their hitting coaches this offseason and already getting underway with his training. So we'll see if anything changes there. I don't think they're looking for him to be a star on offense, but if he could get to league average production, a 100 WRC plus or so, and combine that with what he does defensively, I mean, that's an incredibly valuable player given how good he is with the glove.
And I think, as you hit on there, the bar here is not as high as it would have been for Jazz Chisholm, who kind of came to the Yankees as a league average hitter, hoping to become better than that. For McMahon, it's if we can get to 100, get to average, we're good. Now, I do think it's important to know, as you mentioned, he did pull the ball in the air more. It did come with more whiffs. He went from a 30% to a 35% whiff rate. So I do wonder how that dynamic will affect how aggressive the Yankees are with getting him to pull the ball in the air, where the further out your intercept point is, the earlier you make that swing decision, the more prone you are to chases and whiffs. Gary, from like a personal opinion now, just kind of like taking away from how the Yankees view it, what they think can be done here, what would your confidence level be that McMahon can be that league average hitter in 2026?
I think it's possible. You know, we've seen him in the past with the Rockies get there for stretches, not necessarily prolonged stretches or, you know, any consistent amount of time. But I do think there is something there if you weigh in the ballpark, if you weigh in, you know, or find a way for him maybe to pull the ball in the air a little bit more. I do think that's possible. You know, one of the other things the Yankees said is that they do want to cut down on strikeouts at the bottom of the order. That's typically where you're going to find McMahon hitting. So I'm not sure necessarily if those two ideas can coexist. You know, you want him pulling the ball in the air more and, you know, trying to hit for a little more power from the left side at Yankee Stadium and cutting down on the whiffs. You know, maybe they have to pick one or the other. I don't think he's going to all of a sudden become like a scrappy contact hitter. So I think if you're going to get more out of McMahon, it probably means leaning into his power a little bit.
Yeah, I'd agree. And again, when we talk about the bottom of the order, it's not as if there's also a lot of options to replace players. It's not like there's a star shortstop out there who plays a position well who you can bring in for Volpe, or really any reason to, like, let's say exchange Wells and go get JT Realmuto to play catcher. So it seems like it's going to be a lot of internal, hey, let's hope these guys cut down their strikeout rates if they want to do well on that promise. But we'll see what happens with the bottom of the order there. Now, I do want to kind of pivot off that into the shortstop conversation, because Brian Cashman was talking about the shortstop position. He had kind of left the door open to the idea that Jose Caballero could win that job, like kind of a best man may win scenario here. Do you believe that Jose Caballero will actually get a chance to win that shortstop job if he performs well enough while Volpe's on the shelf with that shoulder injury?
I think he'll get a chance in the sense that, you know, the Yankees aren't going to be able to turn away if he is playing well for through the first month or so of the season. You know, assuming they don't bring in another shortstop, Caballero is going to be your opening day starter. He's going to be your go-to guy when Volpe is out. You know, maybe Oswaldo Cabrera fills in at shortstop from time to time, but as things stand right now, Jose Caballero is your starting shortstop for at least the first month of the season. If he plays really well, I don't really see how the Yankees could just give the job back to Volpe. And you know, Cashman kind of hinted at that at the winter meetings last week. He also talked a little bit about that at his postmortem press conference at the end of the season when the Yankees talked about Volpe's shoulder surgery and his timeline. You know, they softened their tone that day as well a little bit on their standing. You know, it was, you know, I'm paraphrasing here, but it was a lot of, you know, we still believe in the player. We think he can be a good player, but, you know, there was one question that day where he was asked, like, is he your starting shortstop? And I think Boone said something along the lines of he'll be in the mix. I think Cashman said something along the lines of, I think so. So we started to see their tone soften a little bit there. And then you saw it again at the winter meetings as well.
Yeah, and I definitely thought it was interesting that, hey, they were willing to let Caballero get more reps towards the end of this past season. So I don't think they're bound to Volpe at shortstop the way that people are in the fan base might think. I think he's just always been their best option while up in the big leagues. Would you say that you think it's a, like, the Yankees are bound to him, or do you think it's something where, like, kind of like what I mentioned, like, he's just kind of always been their best option there?
Well, yeah, I mean, look at what they had in the first half last year before the Caballero trade. It was Peraza, right, who they didn't want playing at all. You know, he kind of ended up at third probably more than they would have liked, but they were never really high on Peraza once he got to the major leagues. So you weren't going to go replace him with Volpe, who, while he wasn't playing good, wasn't hitting well, wasn't fielding well, you at least knew he had the potential to be a really good defender. Now, I know Peraza is, you know, known for his glove, but I didn't think he played particularly well on defense last year, and I think as inconsistent and maddening as Volpe can be at the plate sometimes, you were never getting anything out of Peraza. So they weren't going to make that switch. That was never something that was really considered or on the table. Once he got Caballero, okay, you see him coming in a utility role, in a platoon role. He's making a difference. He's stealing bases. He's getting on base at a higher clip than Volpe did. Now Volpe's got the quarter zone shot. Okay, now Caballero's going to get an extended run. Yeah, it was kind of hard for them to turn away from. And yet they still kind of did anyway at the end of the season once Volpe healed from that last quarter zone shot. So I still kind of see it as Volpe's to lose, with the caveat being that Caballero is going to have a much longer runway here to basically take hold of it.
And it'll be interesting to see how that ends up sorting itself out. We are a year removed from Volpe being a top-of-the-line shortstop defender who runs the bases well, having that contact. It wasn't a good offensive profile, but a lower strikeout rate profile that they might be more attracted to at that position. I don't think we're that far off of Volpe being a solid shortstop, but I do think we're closer than we have ever been to him actually losing his job, which would be an interesting development. I don't know if you have any final notes on the shortstop position you'd like to add.
No, I would just say, you know, at the end of the season, Volpe did seem to get back to what he was defensively. He played a lot cleaner at the end. I have no idea how to quantify, you know, whether the shoulder was impacting him defensively or not. You would think it was to some level. He was overcompensating in some kind of way. But as I said all season, you know, the shoulder didn't stop him from not charging balls. You know, the shoulder didn't stop him from just, you know, staring the ball into his glove and throwing flat-footed. So there were other issues there defensively that I think the shoulder had nothing to do with. Again, can't really quantify how it compensated or how it affected him at the plate. I kind of think the injury and the production are not necessarily related, because, you know, we've seen 3 years now of this from him on offense in particular. The Yankees themselves, you know, we've heard Boone and Cashman offer differing takes on it. So I can't really say that, oh yeah, he's going to come back next year healed from this and all of a sudden going to be this impact consistent player. He's when healthy, he hasn't been that.
Yeah, it's a great point. Again, I mean, to what degree is it injury? To what degree is it, well, he just doesn't hit. That's what he is. That's just a player he is. Now, I do want to shift to his middle infield partner, and that is Jazz Chisholm. And you had an article that dropped this morning about this. Brian Cashman, not in relation to Jazz Chisholm, this is an independent quote, talked about challenge trades. He's referenced trades he's made before that were kind of stunners or interesting ones. With Jazz Chisholm being a player he's open to listening to offers to, but not actively shopping, what's your read on that situation? Do you believe Jazz Chisholm will be a Yankee on opening day?
So to answer your question, yes, I do think he will be. I know there's a lot of rumors floating around the last couple of days. ESPN's Jeff Passan had a report that the Yankees listened on Jazz while at the winter meetings. Teams listen on lots of guys, just like they talk to guys, just like they express interest in lots of guys. Now, that doesn't mean a trade is imminent. It doesn't mean the Yankees are shopping Jazz. It doesn't mean they are, you know, just craving a trade that gets rid of him. You mentioned Cashman's quote about being open-minded to challenge trades. So just to add a little context to that, that was in reference to the Yankees being overly left-handed. Jazz is a left-handed hitter. He is also going to be a free agent after the 2026 season as things currently stand. So, you know, you connect those dots, you say, okay, Jazz could be a challenge trade type of piece. You want to look at other left-handed hitters on the roster, then you could also say Ben Rice, Austin Wells, McMahon, etc. You know, they all fall into that category as well, except, you know, they come with different levels of value, different levels of team control. Jazz is an impending free agent, so naturally there's going to be some talk, naturally there's going to be some chatter, naturally teams are going to check in and see, hey, what would this cost us? As I wrote this morning, Jazz has been an incredibly productive player for the Yankees. I'm not sure if fans realize, but, you know, not just this past season, since becoming a Yankee, since the trade, he's a top 20 player in terms of F-war, and there's only two other second basemen that you could put in that category. So it would be incredibly difficult to replace him. One of the other things Cashman said while he was talking about this challenge trade concept was that he wouldn't deal a left-handed hitter for a lesser hitter just because the lesser hitter is right-handed. So that's something you got to consider too. Another way the Yankees can attack this left-handed problem is the word that Cashman used for it, is upgrading the bench with right-handed pieces. You know, we saw that, you know, They just we saw that last season at the deadline when they get Caballero, they get Rosario, they get Austin Slater. They just re-signed Rosario. So I think they would like to find some room for right-handed bats in their lineup. I don't know that I would necessarily expect them to trade any of those projected starters that we just talked about. But yeah, that basically sums up, you know, these Jazz trade rumors and the challenge trade concept that Cashman was talking about, which I know is a popular topic at the winter meetings.
And I also think when it comes to Jazz Chisholm, as you mentioned, not only has he been extremely productive, he is the kind of profile that I think a lot of Yankee fans have been begging for over the last 5 years. I remember back in 21 or 22 when the idea of the Yankees having a power-hitting middle infielder from the left-handed side who can steal 30 bases, even when not healthy, can steal 30 bases, that was a player who would be incredibly desirable to the team. And it feels a little bit weird for it to be a situation where now this guy getting, like, we want to push him out the door. I don't think the Yankees feel that way, but it's a little interesting that it's not, he's not a guy that fan base has fully wrapped their arms around just yet. I don't know what your thoughts are with Jazz and kind of that situation there, but I personally think he's great. I know you mentioned he's been productive, but I think he's a great player. It's going to be very hard to see them trading for Ketel Marte. So unless they do that or swing a trade for Nico Horner, which you get worse offensively, better defensively, but notably worse offensively, Not sure the second baseman that appeals to me. Bo Bichette is good, but he's not moving me like that. Do you feel like there's a second baseman out there who would do the replaced Jazz thing for you?
I think it would be really tough, like I said, to find. You know, you mentioned Horner and Marte. Those are actually the two other second basemen since Jazz has been a Yankee that are also top 20 players in F4. But Marte's got a big contract attached to him. Horner, I think, is a good player. I don't know if I would rather have him than Jazz. Maybe the Yankees front office feels differently, but yeah, Jazz is a really good player. I mean, I know there are some Yankees fans who, you know, don't love how colorful he is. I know there are some Yankee fans who are unhappy with the strikeouts from time to time, but I mean, he has been a fantastic player with the Yankees. Certainly exceeded what I thought he was going to be when they got him. I thought he could certainly be better than what he was with the Marlins. I didn't expect him to have, you know, 40-40 numbers over the course of a 162-game season. He's been terrific. I also think he's fit in well with the clubhouse. He's done what the team has asked of him as far as, you know, moving off of second base. I know he had some comments last year when he was a couple weeks into that situation where he wasn't all too happy, but he's done what he's asked. He's improved at the plate. He's gotten along well with the clubhouse. I think he's a good fit here.
Yeah, and I also think, and kind of tying this to Horner, because I think we can agree that Cattell's better, but that's probably not happening. Horner, quote-unquote, might be more realistic of an option, but he's also a free agent. So if you traded Jazz, because it's like, all right, let's get out of in front of this. We're not bringing him back. Let's just trade him. And then you go trade for Horner. Like, what would be the reason to sign Horner but not also sign Jazz? Like, that just is, the logic there doesn't really add up to me. I feel like at that point you just let both hit free agency and determine what the markets go from there, and then you make your decision. Now, staying on the position player side of things and staying, I guess, on the market side of things, Cody Bellinger's still out there. And I know that the left-handed bat comment didn't seem like it had anything to do with Bellinger because he hits lefties well. Bellinger, I mean, his market's kind of a mystery. There are teams who are in, but then there are reports about those teams not being in, and it's a whole mess of things where no one really knows who's going to sign Bellinger and for what money. What are your thoughts and reads on the Bellinger market so far? Because I find this one fascinating.
That it's been tough to read. I mean, you kind of said it's been a bit of a mystery. I would agree with that. It's been really quiet on that front. Typically, when you have a Scott Boras client and the winter meetings roll around, there is either a big show or a big decision is made, you know, something that props that lead client up as, you know, the star of the winter meeting, so to speak. You know, last year we saw that with Soto, obviously, and then, you know, Boras kind of took care of the rest of his clients after that for the most part. This year it's a little different. Complicating things are the fact that Kyle Tucker is out there. Tucker's not a Boras agent. The expectation is that he is going to be the higher priced outfielder compared to Bellinger, if you're talking about them being one and two at the top of the market. So Boras is probably looking for Tucker to sign elsewhere, because then the teams that miss out on Tucker that wanted him, now all of a sudden there's a more of a panicked bidding war, a bit of a frenzy for Bellinger. So, as we've been reporting, you know, people on the beat, myself included, you know, the Yankees don't appear overly interested in Tucker. Cashman's been very direct, very open about how much the team wants Bellinger back. We did see him sort of change his tune a little bit, and you know, at the winter meetings, and you know, say things that hinted, you know, hey, if it falls within our price range or what we're looking for our price range to be, I don't think Bellinger is the type of player or the level of player that you just go all in on and, you know, shoot past projections just to get it done. I don't think the Yankees want to really entertain a bidding war there that gets out of control, like maybe they would have for somebody like Soto or somebody like Judge in the past, or Gerrit Cole, etc. I think they want him back. I think Cody really enjoyed being a Yankee. But at the end of the day, you know, if we're talking about the difference between a 5-year deal and a 7-year deal and, you know, $25-50+ million, you know, I would expect him to take the better deal over just wanting to be a Yankee again.
Yeah, and it's, again, it's Cody Bellinger's right as a free agent to go and take whatever offer, take as much time as he'd like, drive up the bidding war, go wherever he wants, all those things. But on the Yankee side of things, and over the last few off seasons, it's kind of proven to be the case. The longer you wait out free agents, usually the team wins, not the player. And we've seen Bellinger fall into that camp before. We'll see if that ends up happening again. All it takes is one phone call from one team who really wants Bellinger for this to go from, hey, I don't really know who's into, oh, wow, he just took a 6-year, $180 million deal, and he's no longer a Yankee. Now, if the Yankees were to not land Bellinger, what would you kind of think as their backup plan? Because I don't think signing Kyle Tucker for more money is a backup plan. That's not how a backup plan works.
That's where things get kind of tough for the Yankees. You know, on one hand, I don't think Bellinger is the type of player that you just go all in on and try to win a bidding war that gets out of control. On the other hand, you're not looking at many great options if you're the Yankees and you miss out on Bellinger. Like you said, I don't think they just pivot to Tucker and give him a $300 million deal. Maybe his market collapses and you're able to get him for, you know, high annual, you know, ABV, and, you know, then on a short-term deal, I don't know, maybe. But all indications so far is that they've only checked in on Tucker. They haven't expressed serious interest in him. That leaves you with incumbents, Jason Dominguez and Spencer Jones, both of which come with question marks and flaws. You know, with Dominguez, he is still a liability in left field, no matter what the Yankees want to tell you about his improvements last year. You know, that's still a big concern. He's also a concern against, you know, from the right side of the plate. Spencer Jones, his strikeouts are still a huge concern. There's still some divide over what kind of player he is, what kind of hitter he's going to be in the major leagues. So those are your incumbent options. There's not a lot of great free agent options beyond Bellinger and Tucker. Trade market, the picture there is a little less clear. You know, you're talking now about a left fielder, opposed earlier in this offseason when maybe you were looking at center fielders. One thing I would think is that if they do miss out on Bellinger and presumably miss out on Tucker or don't enter the Tucker bidding war, then, you know, you're bringing in a right-handed bat to platoon with Dominguez, who would be the favorite to play left field, you know, going into spring training. There's also got Jones from that side. You know, somebody like Austin Hayes makes sense as a platoon type of hitter, somebody who's going to mash against lefties, somebody who's going to add a little defense out and left. But yeah, I wouldn't expect like a superstar acquisition if Bellinger is not coming back.
It's also tricky with trades because you have to, it's two to tango. You have to match up on value. You have to outbid what would be a bunch of other teams who didn't enter or didn't land Tucker or Bellinger. That is a whole mess in and of itself. I mean, the world where the Yankees don't get Bellinger is maybe, like, I don't know if it's the right one for the Yankees in terms of their odds of winning in 2026, but I do think it's the one that comes with the most intrigue as a storyline. So, like, that is the one where it just gets messy, it gets crazy, and I would be curious to see what their pivot would be there. Shifting things over to the pitching side here, the Yankees look like they want to at least look into starting pitching options. The it's not a guarantee they add an impact starter. I know they've improved their depth with Ryan Yarbrough, but what do you think they do with the rotation? What do you think it looks like by the end of the offseason? Do you get the sense that they go out there and add a starting pitcher to the, not top, but like middle or top of the rotation?
I think there's a good chance that they do add a either a frontline starter or a mid to top level starter. They've got a lot of question marks. The problem is they have a lot of starting pitchers, right? You've got Cole, Rodon, Cole, Rodon, and Schmidt all starting the year on the IL. You've got Rodon, Fried, Schlittler, Warren all coming off of career high workloads. Like, that's a lot. It's a lot, right? Schmidt and Cole, they're coming off of Tommy John surgery. That comes with rust. We saw in his debut season with the Yankees how injuries impacted Rodon and kind of threw him off a little bit. We know that if a pitcher gets through a whole year healthy, you know, they're at higher risk the following season. Well, the Yankees got four of those guys coming off of career high workloads. So I think they know they need to add a starting pitcher and a good one, a dependable one. They kind of downplayed that at the winter meetings. You know, Boone said not necessarily when asked if they need a starter. Cashman had similar comments. At the same time, both said that they would like to add one. Who that's going to be, I don't know. You've got in the trade market, you've got Freddy Peralta, Sandy Alcantara, a couple other guys. Free agency, there's been some buzz around Michael King this week. Tatsuya Imai from Japan is somebody that they have interest in. Whether they can stomach his final price tag, that's another story. I would expect them to add a good starter, though.
Yeah, and on that note, with some of the names they've been interested in, King, Imai, I know there's been some trade talk as well. Do you believe that they would be more likely to go down the trade or free agent market, even if it's just a guess, given how kind of muddy that market is?
I think it would probably be the trade market. You know, I think they are interested in Imai, which obviously you're spending free agent dollars there, but that also comes with, you know, some off-the-field perks, which I wrote about prior to the winter meetings, just getting back into that Japanese market and the exposure there, the business opportunities that come with that. That's not to say they're going to suddenly be raking in the same money that the Dodgers are from, you know, their trio of Japanese superstars, but there are benefits to being back in that market, and the Yankees are aware of that. Aside from that, you know, King comes with a qualifying offer. He also comes with a bit of an injury history. Somebody like Peralta, though, he's, you know, on a very affordable contract. Brewers might be looking to get out of that money. You know, on their end, it might be a little bit much for them. So he's somebody I would keep an eye on. I would say, like, him and Imai are probably the most likely, in my opinion, just and based on what I've heard so far. So yeah, I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, and it's interesting with Imai, too, because he's got up until January 2nd, and it looks like he wants to go to MLB. I don't think he wants to go back to Japan. So he's kind of got a clock working against him, and he's also a Boris client. So given Bellinger, I think that is another, like, interesting, just a very fascinating storyline. Even if he doesn't end up a Yankee, where Imai goes, how he performs in the big leagues, I'd assume he's the highest paid Japanese free agent of this class. Is that the sense you're getting as well?
That's the sense I'm getting as well. It looks like, you know, I think when Murakami first entered the market, people were probably saying, people that are more familiar with that market and, you know, more of an expert on Japanese baseball stars, you know, it looked like he was going to be that guy. Now it seems like the market on him has soured a little bit. He's got a lot of questions in his offensive profile where there are some concerns with how his production will translate to the States. I don't think he's a fit for the Yankees at all, by the way. I would think Imai is going to be much higher than him and Okamoto as well.
Yeah, and again, it could get up to $200 million according to some reports. That would be, I don't know if the Yankees are the one handing out that contract, but we'll see where he ends up going, and it'll be an interesting story to follow. Now, the Yankees technically did make an acquisition during the winter meetings, and it was in the Rule 5 draft, which was with Cade Winquest, who they selected their first Rule 5 pick since 2011. What is your read on Winquest, what the Yankees' game plan is with him, and why they ended up selecting him?
Yeah, so I actually talked to Cade last night for a story that hasn't come out yet, not quite sure when it will just yet. But basically, as you know, he was saying kind of the same things that Michael Fishman said when he spoke to us at the winter meetings. The Yankees have really liked him since the 2022 draft. They wanted to pick him right after Cam Schlittler in the eighth round, but Cardinals picked a few picks ahead of them, so they missed out on that. Got a big fastball, can touch 100 miles per hour. His 12-6 curveball also, you know, had a very high whiff rate this past season. Winquest said that he's already chatted with Matt Blake a little bit. He's going to chat with him a little bit more. He mentioned the possibility of adding a sinker. Nothing set in stone there. We know Blake likes his sinkers, though. He's going to be transitioning to the bullpen as a Rule 5 pick. You know, he is now on the active roster. He has to stay on the active roster, or, you know, he's exposed to waivers and then possibly, you know, exposed to being returned back to the Cardinals if he can't. The Yankees have a bunch of openings in their bullpen, so he's going to have a chance. You know, he's got big stuff that they like. They like his extension as well, he said. And he seems really motivated just from talking to him for a handful of minutes last night. You know, one of the other things he added is that his girlfriend actually lives here in New York. So it's a perfect, you know, turn of events for him and just a little extra added motivation to stick on the roster and be a contributor.
Yeah, and again, as you mentioned, the Yankees are really good with pitching development. They've been able to do it for years now with Matt Blake and Sam Breen at the helm. I know, in speaking to some people who like covered the Cardinals system, his feel for spin is excellent, and there it seems to be a bias towards spinning the ball away from righties as a righty, which is an archetype the Yankees have done very well with, whether it's Warren, King, Schmidt. I know he's not of the same ilk in terms of like sweeper quality or even fastball. Like his fastball being a primary four-seamer is different, but just that arm type, that kind of pitch, it'll be interesting to see how the Yankees work with him. Now, I wanted to wrap things up, Gary, with now that we're kind of coming towards the end of the year. I mean, what, it's like 2 weeks until the new year. I wanted to ask you about your favorite story that you wrote from this past year and why that story either A, meant so much to you, B, resonated with you, however you want to justify that. Like, rip about your favorite story from this year.
Yeah, so that's a pretty easy one for me. Earlier this season on Father's Day, I published a piece about Tim Hill losing his dad to cancer and me also losing my dad to cancer, which happened earlier this year, back in January. And I talked to Tim about this because, you know, not only did we both lose our dads, we both inherited, you know, genes that, you know, are connected to those cancers. You know, Tim had cancer himself. I thankfully have not been diagnosed, and hopefully that remains the case moving forward. But you know, I kind of broached that subject with him, just looking to talk to somebody else who went through it and see how they got through it and how that impacted him. And I think he was a little reluctant at first just to really dive into it. And we chatted about it a couple times before, like, actually doing a sit-down interview. And once we ended up doing the interview, I mean, he was just fantastic and open and revealing and talked about, you know, not only his father dying, but parts of his childhood and how he kind of, you know, fell off the track, so to speak, or, you know, off this, you know, the straight path after his father passed. You know, he lost his dad when he was 17. You know, 31 now. I lost my dad when I was 30. So a little bit different place in life where we were at when this happened. But I mean, that's a story I won't forget. It's a conversation I won't forget. You know, we were sitting in a golf cart in the bowels of Yankee Stadium, just talking and laughing and tearing up at times. And I really appreciate that he did that and was willing to do that. And just a little insight into like how good of a person Tim is. You know, he's asked me many, many times since then, not only how am I doing, but how my mother's doing, how my sister's doing, how my girlfriend's doing. Just really, really good stand-up guy.
And I think it's a great reminder that when it comes to a lot of like really excellent stories about baseball, I think they very, very rarely have to do with on the field. They very much have to do with the person and when you can get to know the person and the people involved in this game. I mean, it's one of those things where, as you noted, it's a conversation, I think, that is a lot tougher and more difficult to have. I can't, you know, relate to it on a personal level, but I know that it was something that meant a lot to you. It was a story that I thought was one of the best I read, period, not just in this past year, but just in general reading baseball stories. I mean, you kind of all these aggregation reports and all these things kind of falls to the wayside. They all become one story. That's a story that sticks out and stands out as, on its own, and does a really, again, as you mentioned, like getting to know the person was really, really an awesome part of that story. Gary, I want to thank you for doing this, man. This was an incredible, incredible, incredible time. I really enjoyed talking with you and sitting down and getting to chat. Is there anything you want to end on or add on or link to for the viewers?
No, just thanks for having me on. Thanks for the kind words about the story. I think I've told you before, like, I'm always interested in pieces that have as little to do with what's happening on the field as possible. So that was certainly one of them. But no, thank you for having me on. I look forward to doing it again, hopefully many, many more times.
Yeah, it'll be a great video. I know our viewers are going to really enjoy this one. Thank you guys so much for tuning in. We're going to leave links to Gary's work and his most recent article on both Jazz Chisholm and McMahon, because we covered both those topics. Those will be in the description as well. We're excited to see that WinQuest piece whenever it comes out. And again, we'll see you guys in the next one. Peace out, everybody. Perfect.